My name is Scott Adzik, Dr. Scott Adzik. I serve as the Surgeon-in-Chief at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia.
You know, there's such a great excitement about your findings treating fetuses with spina bifida. Describe, if you would, the advances you are unveiling this week, and then we'll go into a little bit greater detail if you'd like.
All right. Well, to give sort of the 30,000-foot view, we've shown, first of all, that repairing spina bifida before birth is not a cure. But it repairing the defect before birth reduces the need for a shunt tube to treat brain-damaging hydrocephalus and also improve the motor outcomes of the legs of the children involved so that they could walk more frequently, for instance.
Why do you say it isn't a cure? If you are, in fact, encasing the spinal column when you do this surgery, why doesn't it cure the condition?
Well, you can close the defect, but there invariably is already some damage that has already been done, and it's possible that with better technology we'll be able to repair this earlier and earlier in gestation. The issue is that the neural tube, which is the developing spinal cord, the tissues around it are supposed to close by 4 to 6 weeks gestation, very early. And everyone for years, you read in the embryology textbooks, well, that's just the way it is, and then that's what spina bifida is when that process goes awry. Well, we showed experimentally 20 years ago in experimental animal models that it's actually the intrauterine environment, the toxic amniotic fluid, which is basically fetal urine, and the fetus banging around inside the uterus that was traumatizing the developing spinal cord that was exposed in the spina bifida defect. So the point of doing the repair before birth is to prevent the progression of that neurologic or nerve damage by doing the closure before birth to protect the developing spinal cord.
While you're in there, do you do anything else to get rid of that toxic environment that you mentioned?
No, once the amniotic fluid is fine, once the skin and the soft tissues have been closed over the spina bifida defect to protect the spinal cord, that's sort of it. The other thing that occurs is that with the spina bifida defect, the fluid, the cerebral spinal fluid that bathes the brain and the spinal cord, it leaks out through the back before birth. Mm-hmm. And that has an effect on brain development. The back part of the brain is downwardly deplaced, so-called hindbrain herniation, into the upper part of the spinal canal in the neck. And that blocks cerebral spinal fluid circulation in the brain, leading to buildup of fluid, which damages the brain, and that's known as hydrocephalus. Mm-hmm. One thing we've learned is by doing the closure before birth, in many cases, that hindbrain herniation or brain malformation will reverse. Hydrocephalus is less severe, and many of these children don't require the need for a shunt tube to be placed after birth.
You mentioned the shunt tube, but is there any special material introduced at this time when you close the spinal column and when you go in?
No, in most of the cases, we can use the surrounding tissue that's already there. There's a membrane that's there that you can close called the dura, and then there's the strength layer, the fascia and muscle that can be closed, as well as the skin can be stretched across the defect to close it, to make it watertight, so amniotic fluid can't get in and the cerebral spinal fluid can't leak out.
How is the surgery done? How do you go in and actually work on the fetus?
Well, the operation is pretty complex, and it took basically 30 years to develop the techniques. And fetal surgery at first was done just for life-threatening malformations, where if you didn't do something before birth, the fetus would die either during the pregnancy or once the baby was born. So this is a non-life-threatening malformation, so it's a little bit different in terms of philosophy, but the operations are about the same. The mother goes to sleep under general anesthesia, which also anesthetizes the fetus. The general anesthesia also relaxes the uterine muscle so that it's flaccid, so it makes it easier for us to do our work, because we couldn't do our work if the uterus contracted during the operation. We place the appropriate maternal monitoring devices because, of course, maternal safety is paramount in all this, to be safe for the mother who's undergoing some risk to have an operation to help her unborn baby. The abdomen of the mother is prepared, and a sideways wound is made about halfway between her belly button and the pubic bone. The uterus or womb is exposed. sterile intraoperative ultrasound is used to determine the fetal position, and sometimes the obstetrician needs to turn the fetus inside the uterus because we want the spina bifida or myelin meningocele lesion to be immediately underneath where we make the cut in the uterus.
Mm-hmm.
The ultrasound also tells us where the mother's placenta is because that's the crucial hookup between the mother and the fetus, and we want to avoid that. We use a specially developed uterine stapling device that we invented more than two decades ago to quickly and bloodlessly incise the pregnant uterus and keep the membranes around the baby tacked up to the muscle layer of the uterus. We instill irrigating fluid, physiologic fluid, that's body temperature, into the uterus to keep the fetus warm and buoyant, and the fetus stays inside the uterus. So we're working on the back with the baby still inside the uterus. The baby is monitored during the operation with a specialized ultrasound called echocardiography. That's the best way to monitor the fetus. And then the fetal or pediatric neurosurgeon does the repair in layers to basically protect the developing spinal cord, and then we close the uterus and leave that fluid instilled with some antibiotics, and then close the maternal abdomen with an absorbable stitch that will dissolve once she's healed, and then the usual hospital stay to give medications to prevent preterm labor is usually 3 to 4 more days.
That is fascinating. What is the size of the fetus when you're doing all this?
Well, we did the operations between 19 and 25 weeks gestation. So that's where term, of course, is about 37 to 39 weeks gestation. So a little bit more than halfway through the pregnancy. The fetus at 21 weeks gestation, which would be the smaller end, is about 3 inches in length.
And then the spinal column itself must be teeny tiny.
Yes, it's pretty small. So everything, of course, is smaller. We wear special magnifying loops that allow us to magnify things by a factor of 4 to see well, and we use delicate instrumentation to do basically the same sort of repair on the fetus for the spina bifida as one would in a newborn, only everything is a lot smaller.
Since you're doing so much fiddling around in there, does this sometimes induce labor? I mean, does labor start, or do you give drugs or something to keep that from happening?
Yeah, so we try and minimize the amount of fiddling around that goes on, and we the mother, during the operation, as we're closing the uterine wound, starts on intravenous magnesium sulfate, which is a good muscle relaxant, and that relaxes the uterus. And the mother is usually taking that intravenously for a day or so, and then takes a pill called nifedipine for the rest of the pregnancy.
Who is a candidate for this? Would any fetus that is seen to have spina bifida be a candidate for this operation?
Well, no. And it's important to have an idea of what the incidence of this is, because it's one of the most common birth defects in the world, of course. In the United States, it affects about 4 out of every 10,000 live births. So that translates in the U.S. to about 1,500 babies born with spina bifida each year.
Do we know what causes spina bifida yet?
We don't. There may be some genetic factors. In the MOMS trial, which we're going to talk about in a bit, about 10% of patients had a family history of a neural tube defect like spina bifida.
Oh.
And we know it's also very important for folate fortification of food and vitamins can minimize the risk of spina bifida. But I think we've gotten to the point where that beneficial effect, we've maximized that.
Do we see more cases of spina bifida in underdeveloped countries than we do in developed countries?
Yes. And that's largely due to the folate fortification of food in the U.S. and other developed countries.
Now, how do these little patients do who get this surgery in the womb versus those who do not have this surgery?
So this trial, which was just released by the New England Journal of Medicine last night, the results are really threefold. One is we did a head-to-head comparison as a randomized prospective trial to compare fetal repair or repair before birth with repair after birth. So there were equal numbers of patients in each limb, and the initial results are with about 80 patients in each limb. And we found that the need for a shunt in babies who had had the repair before birth, only about half as many required a shunt. And when we looked at the ability of the children to walk at 2.5 years of age, we found that twice as many babies who had undergone fetal repair could walk independently compared to those who had repair after birth. So that's one of the things you look for when you think of the spina bifida problem. You think of a child wearing leg braces or being in a wheelchair. And so there's a benefit in terms of the brain, in terms of treatment of the hydrocephalus problem and not needing a shunt, which is a mixed blessing to have a shunt in place. And then there's a big benefit in terms of ambulation and control of the legs.
That is incredible. So what's next now that you have reached this plateau?
Well, this was a long time in the making because we've been working on this idea for 20 years through, first of all, experimental work and then cautious clinical application and then a rigorous prospective randomized trial sponsored by the National Institute of Health. So what's next is we need to refine diagnostic techniques to determine which fetuses with spina bifida may benefit the most. I think we need to carry this earlier in the pregnancy to even minimize more the damage to the developing spinal cord. I would imagine that we will apply minimally invasive techniques to treat this. I mean, in theory, in the future, we might be able to, under ultrasound guidance, introduce an amniocentesis needle into the amniotic fluid space and introduce over the spina bifida defect tissue-engineered components to make the repair watertight and therefore avoid a big operation.
And how do you feel that you've reached this point? This is a lifetime of work, isn't it?
Well, it's a very good feeling, and it's directly manifested when you see the kids who have benefited. That's really what it's all about. We can talk about statistics and things of that sort, but when you see a child who has clearly benefited, whose life has clearly been changed, who's able to walk, who doesn't have a shunt, who's developing in a normal or nearly normal way, that's pretty cool.
How old are the oldest kids now who have been involved in this study?
Well, the trial began in 2003, so the oldest children wouldn't be all that old. They'd
right.
be maybe 7 years old. Now, keep in mind that we began to do spina bifida repair before birth in 1998 here at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And so the oldest children that we've all followed are in the range of 11 to 12 years of age. So we know from those children that the effects that we've described appear thus far to be durable.
That's incredible. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. You must be exhausted from doing all these interviews. But
now, compared to doing opera,
it's a piece of cake.
It's a cake, yeah.